This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Thursday, as the Bondi COVID cluster grows, Sydneysiders brace for more bad news.
It's been terrible. It's just dead. There's no one here. So ghost town. Complete ghost town.
Definitely is feeling lockdown-esque.
And pop star Britney Spears' big day in court. Extraordinary claims of abuse and exploitation by her family. Well, let's start in Sydney today, and 11 new COVID-19 cases have been recorded in New South Wales. One confirmed case is a state government minister, with several other politicians also in isolation. There are significant restrictions in place across Greater Sydney and neighbouring areas, but the state government has stopped short, for now, of declaring a lockdown. Our reporter Catherine Gregory joins me now. Kat, what do we know about these latest cases?
Well, Sally, as you mentioned, 11 new locally acquired cases since the update yesterday. The good news is the majority of these cases have been in isolation, but two of the new infections are not linked to a known case or cluster, so that is a little bit worrying. To clarify, there is now a total of 49 locally acquired cases in New South Wales since the limo driver tested positive last Wednesday. 36 of those are directly linked to what's been dubbed the Bondi cluster. Testing rates are up, though, and that is good news. There's been more than 48,000 tests done yesterday. What is also concerning to authorities is that this Bondi cluster contains what's called the Delta variant, meaning it's actually spreading faster than previous strains. And health experts say it can actually jump from one infected case to another person in a matter of seconds. Now, plus, that means also the number of exposure sites is ballooning. There's hundreds now across Sydney, and it's a real challenge for contact tracers to track all the people that have visited those venues.
And Kat, these cases have now reached New South Wales Parliament with the Agriculture Minister testing positive. It may be a bit puzzling to people as to why politicians were gathering for a dinner when case numbers were up, but what's happened?
That's right. Yeah, so a lot of New South Wales Coalition MPs have been essentially locked out of Parliament today amid concerns of this outbreak. As you mentioned, the New South Wales Agriculture Minister, Adam Marshall, has tested positive to COVID-19. He's one of four Nationals MPs who had dinner at a restaurant in Paddington in Sydney on Monday night, where there had been another confirmed case. He says he's been in isolation since Tuesday night, but that's after attending Parliament and the Coalition Party Room that day, as well as that budget dinner that you mentioned on the Tuesday night. The New South Wales Deputy Premier, John Barilaro, has told Sky News that that dinner could be a super spreader event, depending on when Mr. Marshall was deemed infectious.
Probably about 60 or 70 attendees, including MPs, of course. Those that would have attended would either be a casual contact, or those that sat or spoke or had any contact with Adam could even be a close contact. So that definitely, I think, will be deemed at some point.
Also, the New South Wales Health Minister, Brad Hazzard, is in isolation. That was after being notified by New South Wales Health overnight that he'd been in close contact with a case that's been detected as a likely positive for COVID. We don't know if that case is Mr. Marshall at this stage. Regardless, Mr. Hazard has said it's a real timely reminder of just how virulent and dangerous this virus is.
So, Kat, no lockdown at this stage in New South Wales, but how else are authorities managing the outbreak?
Yeah, so there are some pretty significant restrictions in place for residents in all of Greater Sydney, the Central Coast, Blue Mountains, Wollongong and Shell Harbour. So that means visitors to homes are limited to a total of five people. That includes children. We're back to the 4 square metre rule in hospitality settings, so no drinking at the bar as well. Now, the biggest one is that in addition to having to wear masks on public transport, masks are also mandatory in all indoor non-residential settings. So that includes the workplace. It's actually the first time New South Wales residents have experienced this sort of restriction. But Professor Tony Blakely, an epidemiologist at the University of Melbourne, thinks these restrictions may not actually be enough to contain the outbreak.
New South Wales without a lockdown probably still has less than a 50-50 chance of getting through without a lockdown, and they're right in that possibility. But the problem is each day you delay means that if you need a lockdown, which I think is more than likely now, it will be longer and harder if they don't do it soon.
That's Professor Tony Blakely there, an epidemiologist at the University of Melbourne. And before that, our reporter, Kat Gregory. Well, it certainly is very quiet in the centre of Sydney today. The CBD is almost deserted as many people have been told to stay home. Our reporter, Carly Williams, is there. Carly, good afternoon. What's it look like in central Sydney today? How quiet is it?
Well, Martin Place is usually bustling with professionals at this time of day, and foot traffic is certainly down. A lot quieter here. Taxi drivers are saying there's hardly any business. I've just popped into a cafe on Pitt Street, and the owner said it was a ghost town. He's usually served up to about 1,000 coffees by this point of the day, and he said he's done less than 200 at the moment. The office workers that I've spoken to out in the street are saying just how quiet it is. The people that are going through the street are going home. One office worker said it feels a lot like April 2020. She feels like there's a lockdown lingering, a lot of people going home, and there's a little bit of nervousness around how Sydney is feeling like this, because it hasn't felt like this for such a long time. We've seemed to dodge a lot of the big lockdowns, and it's feeling a lot like last year in April and March. I spoke to some people in the street earlier, and here's what they had to say.
But yeah, it's pretty dead quiet. There's like three of us there.
And how do you feel the city is compared to usual?
Very quiet. A little bit paranoid about this new Delta stream, but what are you going to do? I'm lucky I'm vaccinated, so that's a bonus, but it definitely is feeling lockdown-esque.
It's been terrible. It's just dead. There's no one here, so ghost town, complete ghost town.
Does it feel a bit like April 2020?
Definitely, yeah. Our building's pretty much empty. We're just getting a little bit of foot traffic from tradesmen that are working in the area, so there's no corporates at all.
What's the plan in the next couple of days for your cafe?
To be honest, we're hoping that we can close because it'll just be cheaper for us. So staying open will cost us a lot more money. So
what happens with, you know, staff wages and stuff? Because there's no JobKeeper, right, anymore?
We don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. We've sent most of our staff home, so they're not getting paid now from now on. So, not sure. We still don't know what to do. So.
That's some Sydneysiders speaking with our reporter, Carly Williams. So are the number of cases in New South Wales expected to get worse, and is a lockdown likely? Peter Collignon is a professor of infectious diseases at the ANU Medical School.
Well, you would expect to see these cases. The good news about it is all these people were identified by contact tracing and already known. The only case that's a worry is, I think, is a 40-year-old hairdresser where there wasn't an obvious link other than he'd been in, working in a higher risk area. So I guess it's good news because the vast majority of these cases are known. The bad news is that here is potentially a mystery case, and they're the ones that are most worrying, because for every one of them, there may be another case you haven't found in the community. But to put it in perspective, the vast majority of cases New South Wales has found have been already identified and were already in isolation, and that's continuing. The numbers aren't going off the scale. They're, you know, trending as you expect with any of these outbreaks. They go for 2 to 3 weeks. You get a peak, and to some degree you see higher numbers earlier on, because with aggressive contact tracing, you're finding people and testing them even before they develop symptoms. So you tend to get bigger numbers up front, and then they tailor down. And the other good news for New South Wales is with the restrictions they have in place, and I might say more importantly, people often doing it before even the restrictions are there, less contact with other people, less going inside, more outside. That also means the effective reproduction number has already dropped, because instead of 10 people giving it to 12 people giving it to 16, you potentially have 10 people giving it to 6, giving it to 4. Not good if you're one of those 6 or 4, but it means the numbers go down and you can stop this epidemic becoming an epidemic, basically, and control the cases.
And Peter, can you give us a bit of perspective, the kind of numbers that we're seeing at the moment in New South Wales, how do they compare, for example, to what we were seeing in December, January?
Well, I think there's still much less, because you might remember in December, January, we had, in fact, two clusters going on in New South Wales at the same time, one in Avalon and then a separate one in one of the more southwest suburbs called Berala, and they overlapped. So it appeared it went for longer as well. But basically, there were at least a couple of hundred cases involved with that. And that was controlled. Now, it was summer, and that actually makes it easier to control because the virus spreads less readily than in winter. But by the same token, to some degree, they've got on top of this, I think, earlier than the one in Avalon, which was probably going for, 7 to 10 days before they realised it was there. There's pluses and minuses, but overall, this is still, I think, at this stage, looking better than what occurred in December, January. But it's still early days, and this strain is more infectious than the previous strain, so we just have to, watch what happens over the next few days.
That's Peter Collignon, Professor of Infectious Diseases at the ANU Medical School. Well, what about the dollars and cents? The small business owners trying to stay afloat in Australia's biggest city are worried about what might be around the corner. Despite introducing limits on the number of people allowed in venues, New South Wales has so far resisted calls for a full-on lockdown. But at the moment, no one's sure how long that will last. David Sparks has been speaking to the people affected.
Busy folks on the streets of Haymarket on the edge of Sydney's CBD are Louise Shaw's bread and butter. They walk into her cafe, buy food and drinks, and put money in the till.
Yeah, we have a lot of, like, office workers, I guess you'd say, local workers, and also quite a few students because we're really close to the main New South Wales TAFE, also UTS, and there's a lot of private colleges around here.
She started the business in November and hasn't looked back. But at the moment, things are quiet, and with talk of a lockdown, she's worried it's about to get worse.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot, actually, because it's been quiet, you know. I thought by now I might be a bit busier, but I am a new cafe, so I'm trying to build up my clients.
How much of a blow financially would it be if you had to close for another week or 2 weeks or whatever it might be?
Oh, yeah, it would be a huge blow. Although at the moment we are open and we're not doing great. You know, we're kicking along. However, I have regulars, for example, that they might come in one day a week because they're working from home other days.
Across the country, the pandemic has hit businesses hard, especially when there are citywide lockdowns. Alexi Boyd from the Council of Small Business Organisations Australia says everyone suffers when the economy grinds to a halt.
Well, if we take the example of the recent lockdown in Melbourne, it goes into the hundreds of millions of dollars per week, and that's just for hospitality alone. But if we talk about those who rely specifically on foot traffic or retail spaces, that is a very difficult offering, and you reduce your staff hours, you change your relationship with those consumers and your clients, and you definitely have a hit to your bottom line.
She says one of the biggest causes of anxiety for small business owners is uncertainty about what's going to happen.
We don't have any definitive understanding or even guidelines on what to expect in the near and long-term future. And this continues to happen with lockdowns all over the country. There's no standardised approach. And this is actually something that COSBOA and small business have been calling for since March 2020, a clear understanding to avoid any confusion around lockdowns, reopenings, and the support that's available to small business.
Is that possible, that clear understanding? How would you create that?
Well, understanding, say, for example, under what circumstances we go into lockdown. Is it going to be a region by region or a suburb by suburb, an LGA approach when there are X number of cases? We know that this area is going to go into lockdown, as opposed to in another state or another area, we've got an entire city going into lockdown. We just don't know from one situation to the next what to expect from the government when you have a state-based approach.
Alexi Boyd says one thing businesses need to know as soon as a lockdown is called is what support they'll be getting from governments.
That's our reporter David Sparks there. Well, there have also been new locally acquired cases of COVID in Queensland today, but authorities are playing down the risk of a broader outbreak, saying the people infected have the less infectious Alpha variant rather than the fast-spreading Delta variant. They're more concerned about Queenslanders mixing with their potentially infectious New South Wales neighbours in school holiday hotspots on the New South Wales north coast. Stephanie Smale reports.
Queensland's border closed to Greater Sydney early this morning, but the state's Deputy Premier, Stephen Miles, says Sydney-siders are still trying to get in, with 20 people turned around at the Brisbane airport from one flight this morning.
Police have been meeting flights at our airports this morning and turning people around. And so we'd like to send a message to anyone in Sydney who is thinking of coming up to Queensland. Please don't.
Queensland's Chief Health Officer Jeanette Young is playing down three new locally acquired cases of coronavirus.
I'm not concerned that any of these three cases are a risk to the Queensland community, and I'm not concerned with that outbreak in that we now do have everyone in quarantine that we believe was at risk. Now, we have to remember that was the Alpha variant, so far less infectious than this new variant that we're seeing circulating in Sydney.
As school holidays begin, Queensland authorities are turning their focus to northern New South Wales, where they're worried families from both sides of the border will mix. Stephen Miles and Jeanette Young are pleading with Queenslanders not to leave the state if they can avoid it.
It's one of the concerns coming into this weekend and into the school holidays, and that might require additional border restrictions. This is going to play out over coming days, and we'd encourage Queenslanders to stay in Queensland.
This could rapidly escalate, so I strongly recommend that anyone in Queensland, unless you have an urgent, unavoidable reason, this is not the time to go down into New South Wales. You could end up exposing yourself and putting yourself at risk, particularly given where we are with our vaccine rollout.
Gold Coast locals are bracing for further border restrictions and the risk of infection from across the border. Shane lives at Burleigh Heads and works in New South Wales.
I mean, there is a bit of fear, I guess, that sooner or later they're going to put that hard border up again, and then we get to spend hours in the car every day. With school holidays next week and Sydney people not allowed to go in the state, they're going to holiday in the North Coast in Kingscliff, Casuarina. That's where people from Sydney go when they can't go anywhere else.
Tourism operators in the Sunshine State are preparing for another hit too. Up to 25% of school holiday bookings on the Gold and Sunshine Coasts are expected to be cancelled. Trish O'Callaghan is from Destination Gold Coast.
We've certainly had an impact as a result of these latest restrictions, and we know Sydney in particular is a significant source market during winter. It is like a roller coaster here at the moment, and anyone in tourism would say it.
It could be as bad as 40% in Brisbane CBD, where it's now unlikely many Sydney siders who are hoping to see Sunday's State of Origin game will be spending the night.
That's Steph Smail reporting. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, a Chilean woman living in Sydney who was accused of involvement in kidnappings during the Pinochet regime has again failed to stop her extradition to Chile. This morning, the federal court has rejected the appeal by Adriana Rivas. The case of Mrs. Rivas has generated enormous interest in Chile, where she's facing charges on 7 counts of kidnapping. She was accused of working in a torture centre established during Augusto Pinochet's military rule in the 1970s. Adriana Navarro is a Sydney-based lawyer representing the families of the victims. I spoke to her a short time ago.
It is actually massive. So what we have now is the confirmation that, first of all, Adriana Rivas is extraditable to Chile. It has taken many years to get to this step now. For the families, it confirms that their search for the loved ones is valid. It also confirms the suffering that they have gone through. And there's an acknowledgement by a court in Australia that someone should answer for those crimes, and that Mrs. Rivas, since she has been charged with 7 counts of aggravated kidnapping, for those relatives should be sent back to Chile and present herself to the courts there.
What's the reaction been like from the families this morning?
They are elated, very emotional. Many of them had a lot of trouble sleeping last night, wondering what would happen. So for them, it is extremely important. It's the second time Rivas is being told your arguments don't have merits. You should go back to Chile. There's a proceedings pending. You left Chile. You've basically absconded from Chile, and you should go back there.
What will happen now?
So what happens now is that Mrs. Rivas has an opportunity to appeal this decision if she wishes. She has 28 days to do so. If she doesn't appeal the decision, then the Attorney General must review the matter and determine whether or not she will surrender Rivas to Chile. There will be an opportunity for Rivas to put submissions on human rights grounds of why she should remain in Australia rather than go to Chile and face the courts there.
How big is this case in Chile? How much attention has it been getting?
It is a huge case. It is the very first case of this kind between Australia and Chile. It relates to matters of human rights violations that are very severe. Many of the alleged co-defendants of Rivas have already been prosecuted and sentenced in Chile. But here we have 7 families that are waiting to hear what happened to the relatives. Where are their remains? What occurred to them? They have a lot of information, but many of those families still don't know where their bodies remain.
So this process isn't over yet?
No. However, for us, it's a confirmation from a very thorough review by a federal court judge that her request to remain in Australia has no merits.
So just to be clear, has she not yet been convicted, though, of any of these charges in Chile? This extradition needs to happen first.
The extradition needs to happen. She was charged in Chile in 2006, 2007 for these seven aggravated kidnappings, and she fled Chile whilst the proceedings were on foot. So the matter has to go back. In Chile, they cannot have a hearing when a defendant is in absentia. So the court needs to complete that hearing first.
That's Sydney lawyer Adriana Navarro. Finally today, pop star Britney Spears has finally had her day in court. In an emotional outburst, she's denounced her father, accusing him of abuse that she's likened to sex trafficking. Ms. Spears is fighting a legal order that gives her father control over most aspects of her finances, career and personal life. I was joined a short time ago by our North American correspondent Barbara Miller, who was in the Los Angeles courtroom.
Well, she had an awful lot to say. Sometimes she was speaking so quickly it was really hard to follow her. The judge, Brenda Penny, twice asked if she could slow down because the court reporter just couldn't keep up with her. It was an angry and an emotional address, and basically she detailed a life, she said, where she was being exploited and abused by this conservatorship, that word for this legal guardianship she's been living under for the past 13 years. She said that her father, who's currently co-conservator of her financial affairs, her estate, should go to jail, and that he absolutely loved controlling her. And she said she was sick of essentially paying for the people, which she does through her estate, who were in control of her life. Some pretty shocking allegations within that testimony. She said, for example, that she wanted to get married and have a baby, but that the people looking after her wouldn't, she said, let her make an appointment with the doctor to go and have a contraceptive device removed. So it was about 25 minutes she spoke for, very quickly, very passionately, and the message was very loud and clear that she wanted out of this conservatorship, and it was doing more harm than good.
And what's the background, Barb? Why was Britney Spears placed under this arrangement?
We don't know exactly, because those details would be details of her medical history. But this was imposed in 2008, and that was around about the time that you'll remember that Britney Spears appeared to be going through a kind of breakdown in public glare. She shaved her head at a hair salon while people were filming her. She then attacked a paparazzi car. This was during a time when she was in a bitter custody battle over her two sons with her ex-husband, Kevin Federline. She was then twice admitted at that time for psychiatric care. Her father then petitioned to have this conservatorship imposed. We didn't hear, of course, details of what Britney Spears' mental health was then or now, but she certainly, in open court, talked about medications that she took every day. She alleged that she was forced to take stronger medications at one point, which made her feel drunk. And she talked a lot about therapy sessions that she was made to do. She's indicated to the court she wasn't against the therapy sessions. She wanted fewer of them, and she wanted them at home. She said going to have therapy in a public office was really traumatizing for her because photographers, for example, could follow her there and take images of her as she emerged from those appointments.
How significant is this story in the US?
Well, it hugely significant. I guess it really gained momentum earlier this year. That New York Times documentary framing Britney Spears was released, and that really shone a light on the case. I think until then, many people hadn't really understood what was going on. So I guess a real turning point in the case today, these really dramatic bombshell allegations from her, although it's not quite clear where we go from here. The court heard from her lawyer, court-appointed lawyer, that she hasn't actually asked him to formally petition the court to end the conservatorship. So the judge didn't set any further dates. We're waiting to hear she said what would happen on that front.
That's our North America correspondent, Barbara Miller. That's all from The World Today team. I'm Sally Sarah. Take care.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre, and I'm from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Online scams are working better on us than ever before. Gone are the days when you could smugly delete the odd typo-written email and know that your identity and your cash were safe. In fact, some investment scams are so convincing at this point, they're taking in people with a very high level of financial and digital literacy. Today on The Signal, the new internet grifts, how they work and what to watch out for. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.